I'm Joe Bianca.
I'm Bill Stanley.
I'm Jonathan Green.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 9:42, Tuesday, February 23rd. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And New Jersey officially legalized marijuana yesterday. So I hope you're ready to meet my new co-host, Shale Finley.
And that's why you're moving back to New Jersey, huh, John? Excuse me, Joe. Good morning, everybody. Bill Finley. I'm a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News.
Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable. And somebody asked me my impression of the Saudi Cup. Here it is.
I don't get it.
This is, I get it. That's his impression. It's a literal impression of the race.
Literal impression, because the camera work was so bad that the angles were so poor that people couldn't get a feel for the race.
I promise you we have better insight than that coming up on the Saudi
maybe,
Cup.
Maybe.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. Entries are now open for the March digital sale in the Keeneland Digital Sales Ring. The Keeneland Digital Sales Ring provides a standalone online auction accessible to buyers and sellers around the world. Keeneland is world-renowned for its live auction environment, and this online tool offers the quality experience you expect from Keeneland sales in an online format. For more information and to enter now, visit KeenelandDigital.com. So obviously this past week was the Saudi Cup. The entire racing world's eyes were upon Riyadh, Saudi Arabia on Saturday. It was a good stretch battle between Charlatan and Mishriff, with the European horse coming out on top in the end. Our European editor, Emma Berry, was there on the ground and covered the race splendidly, I would say. And we brought her on to talk about it and talk about her experience. Let's just get your first blush reactions from the race and how it measured up to your expectations.
Well, as a Newmarket person, I was obviously thrilled to see Mishriff win. I think, you know, the thoughts going into it for most of the people involved were that it really probably would be between the American horses, between Nixco and Charlatan in particular. And as you say, they, you know, it was a thrilling stretch run, but they'd gone so hard up front that it left the race right open for Mishriff. And I mean, extremely cool-headed ride from his young jockey. And yeah, I was certainly roaring him home, because it's lovely to see you. Well, it's a great thing for the Saudi Cup to have a European Classic winner go out and compete in that race. Clearly he's obviously, you know, Saudi bred and owned, and Prince Faisal was very keen to have him run there, understandably. And you know, terrific result for him, who's put an awful lot into European racing and breeding. And really, really nice to see, you know, top class horse from Europe go out and be effective on the dirt.
Emma, thanks for joining us. I wrote in Monday's TDN just how much I thought Charlatan ran a terrific race, all things considered. Maybe I went a little bit too far, but I even compared it to Seattle Slough in the 1978 Jockey Club Gold Cup. In the aftermath of the race, was that feeling also circulating through both Newmarket and Riyadh that he did get beat, but wow, did this horse run a fantastic race?
Oh, certainly. I don't think you can take anything away from Charlatan. And I read your piece and I agree fully. I mean, it was a top-class battle between two very good horses. And probably just the fact that, yeah, possibly, I don't know if Mike Smith, you know, wanted to ride the race again, perhaps he wouldn't, but have gone so quickly. But, you know, you're not going to let a horse like Nixco have it all his own way up front. So I guess he had to do things that way. But, you know, with such a long stretch, it left it open to a horse that, you know, clearly sees out the trip and a bit more in Mishriff, and, you know, and had already proved the year before that he was good on that surface when he ran very well in the Saudi Derby. So he was probably a bit underestimated going into the race, but there's no question Charlatan, you know, a very, very lightly raced horse as well, ran a terrific race.
Emma, you know, it was great that everyone got a chance to watch the race. It was prime time here, and it was just a thrilling race for us to watch. And then afterwards, there was a little bit of aftermath when the stewards came out and actually fined a couple of the jockeys. Could you give us a little background on that and also the fact that it was so transparent?
I mean, that's something that's being clamped down on certainly a lot here as well. And I mean, they, you know, there are rules that should be followed. And clearly David, in David's case, was one over the allowed amount. And it's a very steep fine, no question. But I think around the world, in every jurisdiction, we have to be aware of the perception, the public perception of racing, and, you know, the fact that he's gone over and been handed such a hefty fine. In a way, you know, probably helps racing in that it shows that the sport's taking itself seriously in this regard. You know, he clearly got carried away in the heat of the moment. He's won a very important race for his, you know, he's a retained jockey for Prince Faisal. But, you know, there wasn't actually a huge amount of feedback immediately on the course after that. It was only in the later on that, you know, I heard that fine had been sort of handed down. So yeah, but it's probably a good thing that it's put out there that, you know, rules are broken and jockeys are penalized if that happens.
I wanted to ask, because that's obviously not the only big race in that part of the world in the next month or so. We've also got the Dubai World Cup in a couple of weeks. I wonder if you've heard any rumblings about who might be pointing there, whether it's horses out of the Saudi Cup or maybe other horses from Europe that may have passed on the Saudi Cup. What are you expecting to see in the Dubai World Cup?
It's a good question, because at the moment, certainly from this part of the world, it's very hard to travel to Dubai. We have in the UK, Dubai is on the red list of countries that requires a hotel quarantine on return. So, I mean, that's not an issue for the horses, but it is for the staff that travel with them. So Mishrif, I believe, is on his way back and is under consideration for the Dubai World Cup. And I'm sure they'll work out a way around, you know, making sure the staff are sort of properly, you know, adhere to the rules. I believe some of the horses in Saudi have gone already. Some of the American horses have gone on directly to Dubai. Certainly some of the Japanese have already arrived there yesterday. I'm trying to remember. Sleepy Eyes Todd has definitely gone on. I can't remember which of the others have traveled. Sorry.
Oh, good. I wanted to ask one other question. You know, John mentioned the fines that were handed down to the jockeys. There's also the unresolved issue of the purse from last year's Saudi Cup. Now, I'm one that's going to get up here and complain that Jason Service isn't getting his purse money from the Saudi Cup. But I think it's a little bit murky that they haven't had a ruling up until now. And, you know, if the horse didn't fail a drug test, I don't know what the justification is for withholding the purse. What's your sense? Do you think that there's a resolution to that on the horizon?
It doesn't appear so, no, because certainly if it is being withheld pending the court case, that could rumble on and on for a long while. You know, obviously we're already 12 months on, and you know, from the owner's perspective, as you say, the horse didn't fail a drug test on that particular day. And I gather there's been plenty of testing on his sample since then, and nothing's come back. So yeah, it's a very tricky, and as far as I'm aware, unprecedented situation that the purse money's been withheld from the owners at this stage. But obviously it's an incredibly complicated situation as well. So I don't sense a resolution is anywhere near.
All right, so you are a European editor. Obviously, you did a good job covering the Saudi Cup, but you have a lot of other extensive knowledge about the European scene. I'm wondering, you know, I kind of plead ignorance that I wasn't really well versed in Mishrif before Saturday. He kind of surprised me a little bit, especially on the dirt. What are some other horses that I should be paying attention to as a more casual European racing fan throughout the rest of the year?
Yeah, the different situation we have here in Europe is coming up to our classics. We don't have anything like the pathway you have, the road, you know, the road into the Kentucky Derby with all the sort of very public races leading up to that. There's so often we have horses turning up, even on classic day, that haven't raced at all since, you know, the previous October or autumn. There are obviously, you know, formal classic trials here, but you know, pinpointing at this time of year, the type of horses that certainly the three-year-olds you could be looking out for is a tricky one. Although I have to say, I'm very excited about seeing the return of Max Swinney. I might be pronounced Max Swinney. My Irish friends will probably tell me off for that. He was a real standout for Jim Bolger last year, won the Group 1 Virtum Futurity at the end of the season. And Jim Bolger homebred. And, you know, it's been a while since we've seen a really big horse from his stable. And, you know, he's been incredibly successful over the, you know, recent years in, you know, with New Approach and Teofilo, those type of horses. So, you know, I'll be really looking out for him to come back and hopefully have a big, big classic season for the Bolger stable.
Emma, thank you so much for joining us and for your coverage of the Saudi Cup. We really, really enjoyed reading it. And hopefully we'll talk to you soon again on the podcast.
No problem. Great to see you.
Thanks, Emma. Thank you.
We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. And this is hard work. It's the hours put in before dawn and after dark. It's the sacrifice, the sweat, the failure, and the faith. This is our industry. This is our life's work.
Owning multiple graded stakes winning racehorses like Hard Not to Love and Decorated Invader is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and your chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. So big, big news this week, today, this morning. It broke on the TDN's website just before we came on the air. It came out at about 8 a.m. T.D. Thornton had a really good story about it that you should read on the TDN homepage and in tonight's TDN. There has been a suit. There has been a lawsuit filed by Spendthrift Farm, Ashford Stud, and Three Chimneys Farm against the Jockey Club in federal court over the stallion cap rule, which went into effect in 2020. They're saying that the 140 mare breeding limit that's now being phased in amounts to, quote, a blatant abuse of power that acts as a, quote, anti-competitive restraint and threatens to disrupt the free market nature of the bloodstock business. This was obviously a very controversial policy from the moment it was announced. And I think that there are some stallion farms that feel targeted, particularly by this. And I can kind of see both sides of it. I think, you know, there is something to be said that this kind of restricts the free market nature of the stallion market and kind of unfairly penalizes stallion farms that have popular sires that can cover a lot of mares. On the other hand, there is a dominant nature of certain stallions that may eventually be a problem for inbreeding and kind of, you know, flushes out smaller stallions from the market. So I can kind of see both sides of this. I think the crux of the issue for the plaintiffs in this case is that the Jockey Club hasn't necessarily put forth a concrete scientific study that says, you know, 140 mares is the right number to have to reduce inbreeding. So I think that their argument is, you know, until you produce that study, you know, this is seems like, you know, unfair economic restrictions. On the other hand, you know, there is the conversation about whether there should be a more level playing field and not letting a handful of stallions dominate the market. So, you know, I don't really have a strong opinion on this. It is a big, big story. Very, very interesting. You know, this was Jim Gagliano said recently that he didn't expect any litigation or legal challenges to this rule. Well, here they are, and I feel like this is gonna drag out for a little bit. And you know, like I said, there are good arguments on both sides of this. I would be interested to hear John's point of view because of the three of us, John is the one who has the interest in the stallion industry and the breeding industry. So I'm sure he has opinions on it. He's expressed them before. I assume Bill is gonna pass on this one because he doesn't feel strongly just like I do. But it's a big, big story, and it's been a contentious issue since the policy was first announced, and now that's only going to ratchet up, you know, 10 times with this litigation being filed. So I'll toss it to John and just get his first thoughts about this lawsuit and this development.
Yeah, Joe, and I really appreciate that. And as somebody who does have broodmares and does have a quote unquote dog in this fight, I have been more outspoken on this topic than others, other rule changes or other implementations that have gone on through the various boards and regulatory agencies. Again, I applaud the Jockey Club for recognizing that there is an issue. There's an issue with genetic inbreeding. There's an issue with horses being too closely inbred, which, you know, may cause, you know, excellence and may cause a lot of unsoundness, you know, through our athletes. And I think that we're all trying to get to the point where our athletes are stronger and genetically as well as physically. So certainly the opportunity and the objective, I should say, of the rule by the Jockey Club was to, quote unquote, you know, decrease the amount of inbreeding and increase and promote the amount of safety in the athlete. And that those are good goals. Those are great goals. And I think everyone in the industry would get behind that kind of a you know, decision. But to this day, there still, in my estimation, has not been any published evidence that the 140 mare number, the cap, will promote genetic diversification, nor will it increase safety, you know, amongst the humans as well as the athletes that are in the industry. And we've asked a number of times for people on both sides to come up with rationale why 140 mares is the number. And so far, all we can see publicly is that that's the number that's being used by standardbreds. And based on studies that they have that have been published, that, you know, the 140 mare rule was the kind of gold standard for, you know, avoiding inbreeding or decreasing at least inbreeding in their industry. And their genetic pool is much more dense even than ours. So I understand, you know, why that would be. But it was not astonishing when I woke up this morning and heard that there was a lawsuit, you know, against the Jockey Club for, you know, basically, quote unquote, anti-free market system. And what was a little surprising were the three, you know, farms that were involved. Two of them were obvious, you know, Ashford Coolmore and Spendthrift obviously are the ones that are impacted the most in the industry. And there are some statistics in the article, you know, in the TDN that show why they are impacted the most. They have very popular stallions and they are willing to have basically, you know, not a cap on the number of mares that will be bred to their stallions. And then Three Chimneys I thought was interesting because really they only have currently one stallion that would fit into the above the 140 mare rule. But I think what that group is looking at is the future. Because it's not just the 140 mare rule that is being implemented, but it's actually being implemented as of any foal being born 2020 and later. So any new stallions that they're going to buy are going to be under this cap. Any existing stallions that are already standing, that are already born, I should say, you know, would no longer be under this cap. So I think if I had to put my guess, you know, hat on, my prognostication hat, it's that Three Chimneys is looking more towards the future as opposed to the other two filers are looking at what's going on right now with the cap. But for me, it still has not been proven that, you know, this is the right number, that, you know, a cap in general needs to be implemented. And that most importantly, it's going to promote safety, you know, and genetic diversification amongst the industry. And I think if those are the two tenets that the Jockey Club is standing behind as far as why the 140 mare rule should be implemented, then I think they have to come forward and show what the studies and what the rulings were. Because to this date, my understanding is that there was never really a vote on it, and there was never really you know, any studies that were shown to the public to promote why 140 is the magic number.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what the suit is alleging here, is that this was a decision that was made, you know, by a private organization behind closed doors. There wasn't a lot of input gained from the people who would be affected most by this. You know, John referenced the stats earlier. I'm going to read from the story. This is according to the Jockey Club's report of mares bred, which they release every year. 42 stallions bred over 140 mares in 2020. Of that total, 16 stood at either Spendthrift, Three Chimneys, or Coolmore/Ashford. Those 16 stallions bred a total of 1,088 mares over what will be the new cap of 140, Spendthrift 576, Coolmore 429, and Three Chimneys 83. Nine of the top 10 highest covering stallions stood at Spendthrift or Coolmore, and 13 of the top 15 stood at the three farms bringing the suit. So I think that there's a legitimate beef here, that this is kind of singling out these farms. And I think a lot of it has to do with Into Mischief as well. Like he has just exploded into this superstar sire who has this enormous libido that he can cover 200 something mares in a year. And he's dominating the market. Into Mischiefs are everywhere. You know, you can't swing a dead cat without hitting an Into Mischief, you know, horse in this industry. They're all over the place. So, and you know, just to be frank, there are interested parties on the other side of it that are involved with the jockey club. So it's not as if this is an independent body, a completely independent body that's coming from outside the industry and making this decision based on science. So I get the argument there. At the same time, it's not good for the industry to have so few stallions dominating the gene pool over time. So it's going to be interesting to see how this shakes out. I feel like we keep leveling up on the beef scale. First, we had jockey agent beef, then we had trainer beef, and now we have stallion farm beef. So I don't know how much higher we can go than that, unless we start getting actual horses fighting each other. This is obviously a huge story. There's going to be a lot of developments. There's going to be a lot of reaction. At this point, I haven't seen a response from the jockey club yet, but I'm sure that's forthcoming. So we're going to have, you know, a reaction to this in the coming weeks and months probably. And I appreciate John's insights because he's more involved on the ground when it comes to these kind of things. But yeah, stay tuned, watch this space, as people say, because there's definitely more to come from this. And I think, you know, it's going to be a contentious issue. And I wonder where this lawsuit is going to go, because I think there are valid arguments on both sides. And I'm frankly surprised that it didn't happen sooner. You know, I thought there was such consternation and such, you know, pushback about this from some of the people in the industry that I was surprised it didn't happen sooner. But it has happened now, and there's a lot more still to come on that. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more at greenco.com. So we are very honored and thrilled this week to welcome our Green Group Guest of the Week, the winner of the Saudi Cup over the weekend and one of the most legendary trainers in the world, who is also putting us to shame with his outfit today, John Gosden. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's good to put a tie on again, because we don't get racing much anymore behind closed doors. So I thought I'd make an effort.
And we certainly appreciate the effort. So I'll start with this. You know, obviously you have an interesting background because you trained in California before returning to Europe. And I feel like that must help with a horse like Mishriff, who you have been able to get to a top level on turf and dirt without giving away any tricks of the trade. What kind of strategies do you have as a trainer to get horses to do that? Because it's so rare to see them perform at top level on both surfaces.
It is rare. I remember seeing Charlie Whittingham do it very successfully with some horses, and probably Ron McAnally as well. Look, I think you've got to have the individual. You've got to have a horse that obviously handles the surface, but also for one that's not into it, that has the courage to face the kickback. And I think that's very much the issue. I had many good turf horses in California that could work a mile in a great time on the main track on their own in the morning, but put them in a race in the afternoon and they couldn't tolerate the dirt. They lose their breathing, their rhythm, everything. So look, you need a horse with courage, but this horse has got an action which suits it. It's not a low action. He just tends to grab and get hold of the ground. To that extent, he's been able to handle what a lot of your top riders riding for years in Saudi Arabia, Riyadh, in the King's Cup, and Frankie Dettori would be another one, have always told me it's a very, very good and very kind surface.
John, good morning and good afternoon overseas, and thanks for joining us. I'm realizing that you probably haven't set anything in stone yet, but could you talk a little bit about the goals for Mischief the rest of the year, and in particular, whether we might see you back for the Breeders' Cup Classic?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, he ran in the Saudi Derby last year, so it was very much the plan with Mischief to come back again. He didn't run a lot in Europe last year. He came back, won the Newmarket Stakes, won the Prix du Jockey Club at Chantilly, the Guillaume Donato at Deauville. And then he got stuck in completely bottomless ground bog at Ascot when we're having record rainfall, which most of our horses got stuck in. And then we freshened him up to come here. It obviously worked very well. I had massive respect for the opposition, Charlatan and Nick's Go. I think one thing is very clear, and I think Bob might have said this, is that Belong Straight at Riyadh made a big difference to us because, you know, we're used to straights of 2, 3, 4 furlongs in distance. And to that extent, he really relished the 2.5 furlong straight, which I think in the end just caught Charlatan out in that last 100 metres. So very much that type of track suits him. We plan, obviously, to be running him here in races like the Eclipse, the Eclipse Stakes, and we may even consider looking at a race at the end of the year like the Arc. As regards Del Mar, of course, that's to be discussed on the agenda, but having trained and had a lot of fun at Del Mar, I know it very well, the track, and the finish line is quite a long way away from the clubhouse turn. It's quite a short straight, so whether that would more favour horses like Nick's Go and horses like Charlatan would probably be something that would be a positive for them or maybe not such a positive for us.
And John, when you were watching the race, at what point in time did you say to yourself, I think we've got this?
When he broke well from the gate, and I think a wide draw was helpful to him. It's a little bit like Belmont. That's an awful lot run that back. They started the mile and an eighth. There's actually, you can go a mile and a quarter and go back further. But that long run out of the chute down onto the main track allowed him to stay out of trouble early on. He broke very well. I like the way he was keeping tabs on those two brilliant horses, Charlatan and Nick Scove, knowing that they've got Mike Smith and Hull Rosario. And these are guys who are, you know, they're going a mile and an eighth. They're going a good pace, but they're conserving. The fact that he could stay with them gave me a lot of hope that if he could keep tabs on them around the turn into the straight, he could well bother them. And of course, Nick's Go is incredibly fast. Maybe he just found the whole thing not to his liking, but he got to the straight and he was quickly gone. And then it was turned into a brilliant two horse stretch run. And obviously the further it went, the more confident I am, because our horse has won a classic over 1 mile, 2.5 furlongs. And consequently, if that race was 1 mile, 2.5, 1 mile, 3, he would have been even more up his alley. And the fact that he could do it over a mile and an eighth is a feather in his cap. And what a brilliant horse to take on, Charlatan. He's a beautiful horse to watch him glide over the ground. And he certainly was a very tough nut for us to crack.
I wanted to ask a little bit, but not to turn the page too quickly from your $20 million win over the weekend, but I wanted to ask about Enable because, you know, she really was the people's horse and I think made an impact across the world. I'm not a huge observer of European racing, but she was appointment viewing every time that she ran. I wonder what that was like training her, a horse that you knew was so popular across the globe. There was any extra pressure or responsibility or what that was like considering how popular she was?
I think there's always pressure, but as Charlie Whittingham once said, pressure is a barn full of slow horses, no doubt about that. Look, the weight of responsibility, you touched on the word there, I did find that heavy, and the point that people were watching every single move with her, and you live sometimes a little bit on eggshells, oh, she puts a foot down wrong, you know, all those things that worry you. And I did certainly with her. But the great thing about her, she had this incredibly competitive mind. She came out every morning, liked to be first out, didn't like to wait around. Very proud filly, carried herself well, and was always up there to give of her best. So in the end, you really had to train her slightly containing her. Initially in her younger days, when her slightly wild exuberance and probably her greatest win was probably her first arc as a three-year-old when she was just trying to climb over the field by the huge chateau at the bottom of the bend before the straight. And she was just screaming at Frankie to let her go. As she got older, she got like some of us do and some of us don't. She got wiser and a little more conservative. And it was no doubt that if you were watching her work, she began to work like she got to a lead horse. That's it. I've done my bit. And I said, well, that was enough. Look, she was a great filly. everything went wonderfully until the last race when, unfortunately, there was no pace and it was run like a what we call a bicycle velodrome race. They just sprinted for three in heavy ground. Wasn't a scene. But the wonderful thing is she retired age six, sound, 100% sound, and a really happy filly. And I believe she's already been covered by Kingman.
John, thank you. And I want to stay on the Enable subject. I want to ask you, do you have favorite horses? And if so, where does Enable rank? Not so much as the best horse you've ever had, which I'm sure she ranks well near the top of that, but as one of the what are your favorite horses of all time?
Well, she'd be obviously hugely right up there. I think as a trainer, your favorite horses, plural, are the ones that try their best and give their very best for you. And if that means they win an allowance, a maiden, and that, you know, they can't go a lot better, that's fine. Those horses I always respect and I have great affection for. But in the favorite horse, they're probably for a trainer, a breakthrough horse is everything. And I'd probably go back to 1983 with Bates Motel, who was a somewhat unwanted horse. He'd gone to the sales, no one much wanted him. And I went to the Carolinas to see him being broken in by guess who? Lucien Lauren. And he leant on the rail. He said, "This is a big, ugly horse, John. There's something about it." But this big fella came around with floppy ears and some blinkers on. I thought, that's a great start in January as a two-year-old. But I think a breakthrough horse you have to be very fond of. Royal Heroine, obviously, who won the inaugural Phyllis Miles. She was so fast. And those great duels with Woody Stevens and Sabin, I'll never forget those, breaking track record after track record at Hollywood Park. So, look, obviously, horses like that, they're with you forever in your mind. And right now, we still have a wonderful veteran called Stradivarius, who's won four Goodwood Cups, and he's going to try and win four Ascot Gold Cups. And he runs over little trips like 2.5 miles. So he'd want to go twice around the race and put the track in Riyadh, not once.
Yeah, when you've won 3,000 races, there's a big catalog to look back on as your favorites. I mean, I had even written down Zoffany and Raven's Pass and Alpha Batum and Anne O'Connor as one of my favorite fillies that you trained as well. And one of the things I wanted to ask you, John, is, you know, you worked with Vincent O'Brien, who is, you know, arguably one of the top horsemen, you know, in our industry. What was one of the things that stood out in your mind that you learned from him that you recall on a daily basis?
Well, he had an extraordinary eye and instinctive feel for horses. And he was, you think that he won all of the great jumps races, let alone all of the great flat races, derbies, Cheltenham Gold Cups, champion hurdles. He did everything. But of course, when he came over to Canada, or it might have been when he was in Maryland, he was asked to look at a yearling, and he looked across and he saw another yearling in another paddock, and he said, "I like that one," from 50 yards away, and that was Nijinsky. And I suppose the way he brought the Northern Dancer line over here, which is completely took control, if you like, of the breeding here, and his eye for that, and his ability to train horses to complete perfection. He was a wonderful man to be assistant trainer to, but you sometimes learn more from people who make mistakes, and he didn't make any mistakes. So to that, you just had to work out everything he was doing. And I think the wellness of his horses was everything to him. Had a great staff, which all of us need. If you can't work with fabulous people around you who are your eyes and your hands and your feel as well, then you're in trouble if you don't have great people with you. But he was a lesson to anyone. And he also had a great commercial sense. There've been an awful lot of great trainers who aren't very good at keeping their accounts in order.
I wanted to ask you a more general question, because I think you're known as a guy who enjoys the culture, enjoys a night at the opera, the theater. Obviously those things are restricted these days during the pandemic. What have you been doing outside of racing to keep yourself busy?
Well, you know, probably reading a bit, but the great thing is with the horses, we're so lucky even with lockdown from the beginning and still now. We go out with them, we train them all morning, and then you might go for a walk in the afternoon, but you can keep yourself busy. It's not like we're locked in an office. So we're fortunate that way. I feel for everyone in the arts and the theatre and everything else. It's for them, it's completely heartbreaking. And of course, they're talking now about them maybe opening in June, July, but a lot of livelihoods have gone there. So look, you can do a certain amount online, but at the end of the day, you've got to try and keep your mind right. But we are incredibly lucky that we're able to do our main job every day.
John, you just talked about what you learned from Vincent O'Brien. I'll ask you a similar question. What did you learn from the California traders that you surrounded yourself with during your time in there? And what, which of those lessons are you still employing today?
I think in California, there was probably in California, you trained a lot around soundness. You were always watching everything from your horse's physical point of view. And we all know you've got to get a horse to peak fitness and psychologically in the zone. That is very competitive. I was lucky to be around at a time of magnificent trainers, and the jockeys room there with Shoemaker and Hussein, Lafitte Pinquet, Chris McCarron, Stevens, you go Sandy Hawley. We would be a little bit like a traveling circus, whether it was on the circuit in California or when we went back east. So we'd travel with those fabulous trainers and those jockeys. And if you couldn't learn, and I was young then, if you couldn't learn just listening to them and asking questions, you couldn't learn anything. So I'd have to say it was the most amazing place to cut your teeth and get an education, training on the backstretch in the 1980s. It was a pretty exciting period. The stables there, Angel Penner came back with Phipps horses. I mean, there were the place was packed. You couldn't get a stall. And it was certainly, it was tough getting in races. So you had to wait about three times to get in a three-hour van. There were no such things as optional claimers then.
And John, since you've had success on both sides of the pond, obviously the athletes are, they're trained differently and they look different. Could you just give the audience an idea of what a, you know, quote unquote, perfectly conformed Euro would be versus a perfectly conformed American horse?
Well, I suppose, obviously, with the great American dirt horses, they're powerful. They've got great strength to them, both, you know, through the shoulder. Their shoulder is a slightly different shape and angle to a turf horse, maybe a little bit straighter. The sheer power of them and their hindquarters. And the fact that they're very fast and trained to be fast from the gate, they have this quick stride. They have lead on them, yes, obviously, but you'll find on the whole that the cannon bone and the pastern are shorter than they are with the turf horse. The turf horse can have more of a long raking stride, probably lower to the ground, and they can be quite long at their cannon and slack and long at the pastern. Doesn't matter on turf so much as it does with the dirt horse. And of course, you know, in the grass, you can be running on firm, you can be running on soft. And there's no doubt that we have specific breeds of horses. I mean, the Galileo line who relish the softer ground when it rains. And we have others that, of course, like the real firm summer ground. And it's a little bit with dirt horses. I found down the years, you'd have one horse who'd love it at one track and then go to another track, wouldn't perform. Freshen them up, bring them back to where you come from, boom, and they straight away start winning again. You've seen that yourself. So when they say horses for courses, yes, the conformation's different, the bloodlines are different, and there's no doubt that we used to come to the Keeneland July set, and it was like holding European sale in the middle of the bluegrass, and all those great stallions from Europe would go straight to Kentucky. Now, of course, there are a lot more of those grass stallions here, and a great preponderance, naturally, of proper American stallions in Kentucky and Florida now.
John, looking at your career, there's a very small list of races you haven't won. I mean, obviously, you've won the Breeders' Cup Classic, you've won the Arc de Triomphe, you've won numerous Group 1s over in Europe, and now you add the Saudi Cup to that. At this point in your career, what kind of goals do you have? You know, what's still out there for you to achieve that, you know, maybe gets you out of bed a little bit early in the morning and says, yeah, this is what I want to do now?
Well, most trainers are neurotic, so we get out of bed pretty early. I think very much my time, life, 70 in the spring, in March. I'm lucky I have a son, Thady, who's very interested, and I think a great team working around me here. And I'm just very keen over the next two or three years to see the baton passed over, if you like. We're allowed now in this country to train two people on a license like they do in Australia. So I'll probably do that for a bit. And then hopefully by the time two or three years are down the road, they simply won't need me around anymore.
Well, you certainly have a ton of knowledge to pass on. Thank you so much for joining us, John. You can go back, change into your casual suit now for the rest of the day. We appreciate all the insight and congratulations again.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Talk to you, John.
Bye. Hi.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, John Gosden, will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over four decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
So we are thrilled to welcome back into the fold two members of our podcast family, Alan Carrasso and Brian DiDonato, as we are getting ready to do the 2021 three-year-old draft, an idea thought of by Brian and an idea that Al capitalized on to win the championship last year. Welcome back, guys.
Good to be back.
Nice to see you guys.
So we're glad to have you and good to see your faces. So we're gonna go in reverse order from last year's final standings. Al won last year. I was second. Brian was third. John managed to pass Bill out of last at the last possible moment. So Bill's gonna go first, then John, then Brian, then me, then Al, and then we're gonna snake back and forth. Five horses each. The rule is you have to pick at least one horse who currently has zero Kentucky Derby points, which is a little bit easier this year because we're much earlier in the prep season. The Fountain of Youth is this Saturday. I think that'll really kick off the bulk of the big Kentucky Derby preps. So without further ado, let's get it started. Bill Finley, you are on the clock.
So I'm like the Jacksonville Jaguars of the league. Is that how it works?
Actually, right.
Yes. Well, John, you've been asking me, hounding me, a matter of fact, for days about who I was going to take. Nothing too fancy here. I think you could flip a coin between essential quality and life is good. And really, for no reason other than he's running this weekend, and I thought he was terrific two-year-old essential quality.
That makes sense.
Jockey start. Bill goes with the two-year-old champion.
All right, and as the New York Jets of the contest, I'm going to pick the other side of the coin, because life is good.
It's not if you're the New York Jets, but life is good for you. All right, Brian, you're up.
I'll go with Greatest Honor in spot number three. He's going to run this weekend as well. He reminds me a lot of Orb. I went back and looked at Orb's PPs. The knock on Greatest Honor right now is that he's not fast enough, but he feels like one of these Shug horses that kind of probably wasn't super pressed early, pushed along, just sort of figuring it out and hopefully blossoming going into the rest of the preps.
He was actually number one on my draft board, so that sucks for me. And he did get a big Thoroughgraph number for his last race. So that throws my plans in flux a little bit. But I'm going to go with a horse that I liked from the beginning. I'm afraid that he's a little bit too fast for his own good. But I'm going to take Caddo River, number four. I just thought his race in the Smarty Jones was too brilliant to not take him in the first round. I think he's the best of a loaded Brad Cox contingent. So Caddo River for me at number four.
All right. Number five, I'm going to horse not going to run this weekend, but next weekend. Was very taken by risk-taking this victory last time in the Withers. He's won two times going mile and an eighth in his four starts. I think that's fairly significant. And he seems one that the distance isn't going to matter. It seems like he's getting better. So I'll go with him at number five. And then wrapping back, I will land on Mandaloon for number six. I like what he's done so far. Really ran an improved race with blinkers on last time. And I think he's going the right direction. So Mandaloon six.
All right. So turns back to me now, another pick right before me that I wanted. I'm going to go with my horse that has no points right now. It might be a little bit early to take him, but I just thought his debut performance was too good to pass up. I'm going to take Dream Shake as the number six pick, as my second pick. He got a huge sheet number first time out. Obviously, it was only one sprint race, so who knows if he can back that up. But I'm going to go with Dream Shake and get my 0 point horse out of the way.
That would have been my pick there, but I guess I'll take Concert Tour, another Baffert. He's also a no points horse. The race he won didn't have any points, so I think he'll stretch out.
Very nice, very nice. I'm going to go with Proxy, who was second in the Risen Star and never worse than second in any of his five starts. Sonnet Tappet, and I think we'll continue to improve as the races go further.
Medina Spirit. That's all I have to say. Medina Spirit.
All right. You got another pick now, Bill.
Another pick now.
Okay. All right. Keep Me in Mind.
Well, I'm going to go with my 0 point selection, Senor Abuscador.
God right. Damn it! All right.
Saw that coming from a mile away.
If you want, we may be able to work out a trade, Mr. Bianca. But Senor Abuscador.
I already got my future bet. So I'm
Wait, Al, your comment's pretty funny. You can see it coming from a mile away because comes from way behind.
That's great.
Yeah, I got. We need a little Al Carrasco humor here.
Got 39-1, John. So I'm okay. Brian, go ahead.
Who's your pick, Joe?
It's Brian's turn now.
I guess I'll go with Roman Centurion. I thought I really liked him, and then I watched his last race again. He hung a little bit, but he's got all the right credentials. Obviously, should appreciate added distance. So I'll go with him.
I feel the same way. I made him a rising star, but I thought that was a little bit of a hang job last time. There's a horse I kind of want to take, but I'm a little bit worried that he's not going to make it to the Derby. So I'm going to take the Great One. He didn't have that great of a 2-year-old season, but that big maiden win last time was too good for me to pass up. I'm going to bank on him being able to back that up. So I'll take the Great One.
All right. This is a bit of an oddball pick even for me, and that's saying something. I liked what I saw from Cowan the other day, and he surprised me. I kind of pigeonholed him as a miler at max. And I thought the way that, I mean, he walked out of the gate and really finished up running. It was past the winner, a couple steps past the wire. I think he could see out another furlong and a half. He's going to go in the UA Derby. That's a 100-point race. He may or may not make the Derby, and honestly, he's kind of a one-trick pony for me, but I think he's sneaky. And if anything, the Saudi Derby showed me that the horses that had form through other horses going to the UA Derby makes me believe that those horses aren't that good. And I think Cowan could clean that up. So Cowan for me in that pick. And then I'll take I'll give Hot Rod Charlie a chance to improve going forward off his comeback race. So Hot Rod Charlie for me, round four.
All right. So I think this is good value. I don't particularly like his chances at a mile and a quarter, but I think he's talented enough that it's good value right now to take Jackie's Warrior as my fourth pick. I can't pass on his talent level, even if I'm not totally sold that he wants a mile and a quarter. So I'll take Jackie's Warrior for my fourth pick.
Yeah, I probably would have done that if he got to me. I'm in the same boat. I don't exactly love him. He should have an advantage this weekend. I think he's one of the big horses in the race at Oaklawn who was training at Fairgrounds. So he should have he might run second this weekend, but he could definitely win. I'm going to go with Hidden Stash, a little bit of a sleeper. Was third in the Sam Davis. I thought he was the horse you want out of there. I think he's a true mile and a quarter horse, son of Constitution. I think he's probably flying pretty far under the radar right now.
I am surprised that this horse has made it this far, but I'm going to go with Midnight Bourbon. Midnight Bourbon, the improving son of Tisnow, who has tactical speed. I don't know if he can go the distance, but I think he'll be able to take care of the next couple of races, get some points for me. I'm going to go with Midnight Bourbon.
All right. Also very surprised this horse is still around because it's a 0 point horse that has gotten a lot of hype, and that is Prevalence.
Yeah, I was surprised he was on the board too. I just worry about Brendan Walsh maybe being a little bit too cautious with him, but he's obviously got a ton of talent. So. All right, so that's Bill's fourth pick, and then you're on the clock once more for your final pick, Bill.
All right, Candyman Rocket.
Ah,
Sam Davis winner.
Okay. How dare you? How dare you take my last horse off my list? All right. Now I'm going to go with another 0 point horse just because I think that he's got some running ahead of him. And that's the Chad Brown trained, highly motivated. He hasn't made his three-year-old debut, but he's a son of Into Mischief, and he's going to run in the Gotham. And I think that's a good spot for him. You know, I couldn't choose between the two Chad Brown horses, you know, between Risk-Taking and Highly Motivated. So I'm glad to see that one of them is still on the board.
I guess I'll go with Ron Bauer to round up my picks. He needs to get a little faster. I liked him in the juvenile, and I didn't think he ran badly. And, you know, he was very visually impressive at Golden Gate, even if it didn't get much of a figure.
All right. So my final pick here, I feel like I'm required to take a Bob Baffert horse. I'm going to take Freedom Fighter. He's not fast enough yet. He has to get a lot faster. But, you know, I thought for only his second start and coming off a layoff, he ran pretty well to only be a neck behind Concert Tour. And I feel like he's decent value at this point in the draft. So I'm taking Freedom Fighter as my last pick.
I'm going to an allowance race on the Risen Star undercard for my 0 points horse. I was between Big Lake, who ran a giant race with a very wide trip, and Defeater, who really caught my eye first time, a Union Rags colt, who won in spite of himself, going 6 furlongs first time out, and then really was against the track, I thought, a couple weekends ago, and ran a giant race from off the pace. Was getting to Big Lake, even though that one had a wide trip. But I think Defeater will improve with stretch out and distance. I'm hoping that they roll the dice a little bit and take a chance in Louisiana Derby. So Defeater, Union Rags Colt is my 0 points horse.
Let's recap our five picks each for the viewers and listeners. I got Cattle River, number one, Dreamshake, number two, The Great One, number three, Jackie's Warrior, number four, and Freedom Fighter, number five. Bill, let's hear your team.
Not to jinx you, Joe, but I love your stable. Good job. To get Freedom Fighter that late in the draft is pretty good. I think you will be tough to beat. I predicted you'd win last year, too. Remember that? So. Okay.
You'd win after the first pick. Yeah. It's over.
We'll be for this year.
Yeah. Well, I came close anyways. All right. I took Essential Quality as the number one, as the Trevor Lawrence of this draft. The obvious number one, Medina Spirit, Keep Me in Mind, Prevalence, who is as talented as any three-year-old out there. But again, is he going to make the Derby? That's a big question mark because he's late to get going. And then Candyman Rocket, the CMF Davis winner.
Good, John.
I started off with Life is Good, the undefeated three-year-old of Baffert's, followed up in no particular order by Proxy, Midnight Bourbon, Highly Motivated, and just to piss Joe off, I picked Senior Buscador probably a round too early, but it was just worth it just to be able to say Senior Buscador and see his face, you know, defeat right there. It might be the only time I see his face of defeat, because I agree with Bill. He's got a hell of a stable right now.
All right, Brian, go ahead.
Went with Greatest Honor first, Concert Tour second, Roman Centurion, Hidden Stash, and Ron Bauer. I'm kind of California heavy this year, but you know, I'm happy enough with it.
Very much so. Let's go to the champion.
Gone with Risk-Taking, Mandaloon second, Cowan to win the UAE Derby, Hot Rod Charlie to improve, and real dark horse in the form of Defeater.
All right. So I think good stables, one and all. No supplemental draft this year. Don't worry, Brian. So I think we've got a level playing field off the jump. Get started, like I said, this Saturday in the Fountain of Youth. Thanks to you guys for coming back on. We look forward to having you on the podcast again in the future. Is there anything you want to say? Is there anything that's been built up inside of you being off the podcast for this long that you've been dying to tell the world?
No.
Okay. All right.
No.
All right, but since you guys are sitting here,
let me ask you one question. There were a couple of horses that were on my list that didn't get selected. Fire at Will and Spielberg. Anybody have any thoughts about that?
I thought about Fire at Will, but I don't know. I don't trust those turf horses trying dirt this late in their careers. You know, but I thought about him because he's running this Saturday, I believe. I think he's in the Fountain of Youth.
He's in the Fountain of Youth. And Spielberg, only because he ran such a huge number and, you know, he's a $1 million yearling and he's going to run in the Southwest. He's owned by the Avengers, you know, trained by Baffert. That was the only other one that was on my list that wasn't selected. I was just wondering what you guys thought.
Yeah, he seems a little slow to me. Maybe should have been taken was Drain the Clock, who's also running in at Gulfstream this weekend. He's right. little bit of a stretch out question mark, but he was super, super impressive last time.
Yeah. How about the Rotary Derby that goes is not going through Florida for the first time in a millennium? It looks like all the top horses aren't in Florida this year. The top horses, at least according to our selections, are California.
Brian's the greatest honor.
Yeah, but that's it. I mean, like I don't know about you guys. When I went through the preps, the Tampa Bay race and the Florida races in general weren't as impressive to me as the fields in some of the other races. And I think it showed in this draft.
I think the Tampa race was very slow. It was hard to take those horses too high. Al had a thought that we cut him off.
I thought Smiley Sabatka, I don't know what happened to him last time, but I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he just didn't like Tampa, which wouldn't be the first time a horse didn't like Tampa and then popped back up and ran nicely. But I think he could do something going forward.
For sure. All right, so that was a lot of fun, and we look forward to having you guys back on and talking about the draft. So thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Good to see y'all.
You too.
So last week's racing weekend was pretty quiet, other than the Saudi Cup, but definitely stateside, it was pretty quiet. Not so this Saturday. We have a big weekend of racing coming up. Gulfstream was always going to have a big weekend of racing. This is the Fountain of Youth Saturday. They got a bunch of stakes going on. They got the Canadian Turf, the Devona Dale, the Fountain of Youth, the Here Comes the Bride, the Honey Fox, the Mac Jarmida, and the Very One, as well as the Palm Beach, which is ungraded, and the Grade Two Gulfstream Park Mile. So that's a loaded card. That's 8 stakes, I believe, right there. So we're looking forward to that. Obviously, the main attraction in there is the Fountain of Youth Greatest Honor, who won the Holy Bull very impressively, is going to be back in there. Fire at Will is going to make his dirt debut in there. Drain the Clock, who won the Swale, is going to stretch out to 2 turns. Tarantino, who was a good second, I thought, in the Holy Bull, is going to run back as well. So a lot of horses coming from different directions there. So that should be good. In the Devona Dale, there's a couple fillies who are among the top Kentucky Oaks contenders who are going to be in there. VQuist, obviously, is the big name, the defending, the 2-year-old filly champion. She's going to be in there. Curlin's Catch is going to be in there. There might be a couple other Oaks contenders that race on Saturday as well. Stakes, loaded stakes card at Gulfstream, but also we have the Southwest at Oaklawn, which was obviously not scheduled for this Saturday. It was supposed to be run a little less than 2 weeks ago on, I guess it was last week. It's going to be less than 2 weeks ago this Saturday from when it was supposed to be run on President's Day. So obviously that's a big matchup there with Essential Quality and Jackie's Warrior. But I think they're going to get a bigger field now than they would have, you know, on the originally scheduled date. I think they're probably only going to get like 5 or 6 horses. They'll probably get like 8 or 9 horses in here who have maybe needed a little bit of time to get back to their races. And then we have the Razorback, which looks like it's got a pretty competitive field. And then Monomoy Girl is supposed to return in the Bayakoa. So there's going to be a lot of star-studded action this weekend, and there's going to be a lot to react to next week. And we're super excited to get the Derby contest started. There'll be a couple horses picked in that are going to run in the Fountain of Youth on Saturday. But I'm wondering if Bill has any thoughts about the upcoming races.
Yeah, Joe, I think what's particularly interesting about this weekend is not just there's a couple of good races out there on the road to the Kentucky Derby, but we're going to have questions answered for a ton of horses this weekend. And you start with Fire at Will. He did win last year, by the way, on the With Anticipation Stakes, which I believe came off the turf. So he does have a dirt win. But Fire at Will, Breeders' Cup turf, juvenile turf winner. How does he stack up against the best horses on the dirt in the U.S.? That's a complete unknown. Prime Factor, remember him? He looks like he's going in the Fountain of Youth. That was that Todd Fletcher horse that ran off the screen. I assume he was the TDN Rising Star in his first start and came back and didn't run that great in the Holy Bull. He's going to try again. Drain the Clock, as you mentioned. You know, we know he's terrific up to 7 furlongs. He won the Swale. How will he do it a mile and a 16th? That is a question to answer. And then the big question horse, or the one that's got something to say so far as which direction he's going in, is Jackie's Warrior in the Southwest Stakes. I mean, this is a huge test for him. If he doesn't pass this test, I'm sure they'll just decide that he's a sprinter. If he does, he's going to vault right back up toward the top of most people's list, because he was probably the most talented 2-year-old that ran last year, but he appears to just have distance limitations.
Yeah, I think a lot of it also has to do with his running style and whether or not he's able to rate and come a little bit from off the pace, because, you know, he showed so much brilliance, but he did it on the lead. You know, he did it when he was given an easy lead in the Champagne. He wasn't given an easy lead in the Hopeful or the Saratoga Special. He was just faster than everybody. But those are 6.5, 7 furlong races. Obviously much different going 2 turns, 1 mile and 1/16, which he's going to do on Saturday. It's a good point about Fire at Will. I forgot about that washed off race that he won. But yeah, I think Jackie's Warrior, you know, even though his pedigree suggests he's going to become a sprinter, I think that if Steve Asmussen can get him to relax a little bit off the pace, I think that'll be much better for his chances of seeing out the 1/16 and then eventually the 1.25 for the Derby, because he ran really well in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. I know, like, he was the favorite and he ran fourth. So that's, like, I guess for some people automatically disappointing, but considering the circumstances of the race, he ran, I think, a terrific, terrific race. So I'm really excited to see him and Essential Quality. You know, Essential Quality obviously was a very nice 2-year-old, but I don't know that he is that much better than the rest of the 3-year-olds right now. Maybe he will be, and maybe he'll show that on Saturday, but I thought, you know, a lot of his reputation is based on 2 races where he got very good setups in the Breeders' Futurity and in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. Now, obviously, he was still good enough to run those races and win going away, but I got to see him do it, you know, as a 3-year-old against horses that have since developed. I'm sure he's developed too, but against horses that have since developed into much better colts. So it's tons of intrigue in that race in the Southwest. Like I said, I think there's going to be a bigger field now because of the delay of the race. Spielberg is probably going to go in there. Keep Me in Mind is going to be in there. So I think they're going to get 8 or 9 horses as opposed to the 5 or 6, like I said. So Bill's right. Lots of questions to be answered. Lots of horses coming from different directions. So we're looking forward to that and looking forward to, you know, seeing the first big statement weekend of the Derby prep season. You know, we've had a couple at Fairgrounds and one at Gulfstream, but I think this is the first weekend where we're really going to learn a lot about the top contenders right now for the Kentucky Derby.
And Joe, don't forget, we there were so many good races this weekend, and you guys mentioned the majority of the highlights. Got Stormy is coming back also, and she's coming back for her 2021 debut. I mean, all she's done is made $2 million and sold for a couple million at auction, and now has new owners in Spendthrift and MyRacehorse.com, and she's going to be running in the Grade 3 Honey Fox. So, I mean, it's a star-studded weekend all over the racing calendar.
Yeah, and so it's interesting that Monomoy Girl and the God Stormy, who Spendthrift bought both of them for big money, both going to make their seasonal debuts this weekend. And it'll be interesting to see what Monomoy Girl uses this as a springboard to. Okay, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. A reminder that entries are now open for the March digital sale in the Keeneland Digital Sales Ring. Learn more at KeenelandDigital.com. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, Brian DiDonato, Alan Carasso, Emma Berry, our Green Group guest of the week, John Gosden, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Ritz, and our editors, Nathan Wilkinson, Danny Seiper, and Aaliyah LaRocca. Thank you so much for watching. Please wear a mask. We'll see you next week.